So, let's start then with the Zulu army. The Zulu army, high reputation it deservedly has with the Natal colonists. They fear the Zulu army for its size and its justifiable reputation for high discipline. They're probably the most well-drilled and well-disciplined warriors in the African subcontinent. Perhaps, arguably, up there with the bravest of them. Kipling says that the Fuzzy Wuzzy in the Sudan was the bravest of all our opponents. And there is some justification for that. They did act in a particularly suicidal manner. Not an attribute that the Zulu army would display. Now, Zulu warriors who fought at Rorke's Drift belonged to four regiments. They were four regiments that were in the reserve at Isandlwana, so they arrived on the battlefield fairly late, and they'd had to accomplish a fairly long circuitous march that took them round the back of the mountain at Isandlwana. So when they arrived, they were probably quite tired. They're not the youngest of men. The regiments involved were in the age range of the late 30s into the mid 40s. So they're senior warriors. Now, the way the Zulu army recruited its soldiers, if you like, they were effectively a feudal society. So every member of that society owes allegiance and military service to the king. So when they're of certain age, like in the British army in conscription times, they were inducted into a Zulu regiment. Now, those regiments would have the same traditions and values of a British army, and they would display them on their shields. The shields would start dark black, mostly plain black cowhide, and as they advanced through the rankings, the shields would become lighter until the most senior regiments had a pure white shield. By the time of the Zulu War, the shield patterns were starting to perhaps go a little awry because of the difficulty to arrange cattle of the same colour. But, in theory, those regimental traditions should have been kept. So, when a Zulu boy is inducted into the army, usually at the age of around 18, he'll go into a regiment with his fellows and they'll serve together for the entire length of their military service. They'll camp together when they come together for a campaign or just for training. They'll fight together and then they'll disperse to their homes. They'll come from all over Zululand, and when they're summoned, they'll come to the royal kraal, join together, take part in the ritualistic preparations for combat by their witch doctors, and then they are ready for military service. They're ready to go into action. When they go into action, they use a variety of weaponry. Now, I'm not going to start showing you spears first, ladies and gentlemen, because the Zulu were more than knowledgeable about firearms. Quite a number of them had been employed as hunters by whites. They traded in guns, and it may surprise some of you to learn, not you Zulu war aficionados out there, that probably in every four Zulu warriors there'd be three firearms at least. Now, the typical firearm of the Zulu warrior is like this. Now, this is an 1853 pattern Enfield rifle. They call it the three-bander because it has three barrel bands on it. It's rifled. It was first used by the British Army in the Indian Mutiny. It's a very good arm, very accurate, and a considerable improvement over the smooth bores that came before it. It's a muzzle loader, so you have to use a paper cartridge and bullet rammed and tamped down tightly, and you use a percussion cap here to set off the charge at the bottom of the barrel here. So, fairly crude by comparison to the British arms that we'll look at shortly, but quite effective in the hands of someone that knows how to use it. The shortcomings in Zulu hands, if their marksmanship was up to the job, that's fine. Probably the quality of their powder, percussion caps, and their bullets themselves would be inferior. So, whilst you may not be unlucky enough to be struck by the Zulu that's firing at you, the Zulu army could put up a considerable amount of lead into the air when they let fly with this assemblage of firearms that they have. Some will still be using the smoothbore musket, perhaps a flintlock, really old-fashioned, but still able to put legs in the air. I say legs in the air because Zulus often use pot legs ripped off the back of these big cooking pots to use as their ammunition. So, the firearm is, I won't say the primary weapon, but a lot of Zulus certainly use them.
What was its range?
The M-filter, it's sighted to, this one's a smooth bore, but I think the rifled version is sighted to about 650 to 800 yards. But I mean, that's wishful thinking. That is wishful thinking. I mean, in the Indian Mutiny, we're engaging targets at 300 and 400 yards with it, quite effectively, sometimes single men. So it's a good arm. It's a good arm. So the traditional Zulu weapons. Last time I did this talk, I was accompanied by Prince Shangi, the Zulu descendant of Prince Dablamanzi, and he was able to pronounce these names very, very effectively. I'm not even going to try. This is a shield. It's cowhide. Ian Knight will give you the pronunciation later if you want it. He's standing behind. I just clocked him there. So this is the war shield. And again, there's a very excellent one brought along by one of Ian's colleagues on display in the museum here, which is probably the finest example of Zulu war shield from the Shaka period you're ever going to see. Because in Shaka's day, they were very broad, very tall. You could literally hide yourself behind the thing. By the 1879 campaign, they're starting to shrink. They're shrinking down to this size and even smaller. Some warriors, realising that you can't deflect a bullet with this, will only encumber themselves by one perhaps half its size. These are reputedly dancing shields, but they're most certainly not. A lot of Zulus use them in combat. When Zulu warriors drill, they drill for close combat, because close combat is the way a Zulu warrior gains his honour. In the British Army, you get the Victoria Cross by an act of courage. In the Zulu Army, that act of courage will involve hand-to-hand combat, face-to-face. So they will seek it on the battlefield. They'll use their weapons like Highlanders, and at the appropriate moment, they'll drop those firearms and they'll go in hand-to-hand. When drilling against each other, they'll develop techniques with the shields to butt their victims to the ground, to hook their shield behind their similarly armed opponent and pull him down, ready to make the thrust into his undefended body. So quite useful in hand-to-hand combat. Even facing a British soldier with this, if you can catch a bayonet in it and turn it so it doesn't allow the bayonet to come out, you've got that Tommy at your mercy, effectively. So even though it's cumbersome to carry, quite an efficient piece. When you're advancing, if you're advancing through long grass, which is typical in Zululand, you can carry it slightly offset to perhaps fool your rifle-armed opponent into thinking you're a couple of paces over the other side. You can turn it to conceal when you're coming forward, or present it to intimidate with your numbers if they are great. So most certainly not an anachronism, even in 1879, for the Zulu warrior. Hand-to-hand weapons. When a Zulu force moves to contact against another tribe, perhaps, they'll start with a shower of these. This is the assegai, and this is the throwing spear. We have a number of them on display for you here. You can see they're beautifully balanced. We were having a chat last night to see if anyone's ever actually thrown one of these. But as they're all highly prized collectibles now, Oh, there's a gentleman there. How well do they throw, sir?
I throw rock.
Oh, well, that's a lack of training, sir. Lack of training.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, you can get quite a range on them, apparently. Probably 30 to 40 metres will be easily achievable. And the Zulus will use these like a Roman legionary. When the Roman army advanced towards its opponents, it would release a shower of pila, spears, javelins, which would embed themselves in the shields of their opponent. They then bend, and the weight would drag the opponent's front rank shields down and give them a major disadvantage. The Zulus work in exactly the same way. A shower of these will discomfit the enemy and make them all, they'll be ducking and bobbing and weaving and trying to catch them on their shields if they're shield armed. If they're British soldiers, you've got a major problem because you have nothing to deflect it except perhaps your arm or your bayonet. So if they can get close enough to use them against us, there is a place for them. And a number of knots of men locked together fighting back to back at Isandhlwana would certainly have fallen victim to thrown shields, quite a number of them. So the assegai too has its place in combat. But the weapon for which the Zulu army is most and justly feared is this, the ikwa. I can pronounce that one all right, you don't forget that, because it's the sickening word that describes the thrust of a Zulu ikwa into the chest of his victim, and that horrible sucking ikwa noise as it's withdrawn, as the flesh grips that blade there. And look at the blade, look. Long, like a Roman sword, really, that sort of length and size, designed to inflict massive shock injury to stop the opponent fighting, even though he's been disabled badly. Wherever you receive that wound, you are going to stop fighting and worry only about the wound that you've received, and that's the idea behind it. African warfare before Shaka was almost a hobby. They would indulge in throwing competitions, and a few men might get a graze and they'd all go off home again. Honor was satisfied. Shaka fought war to kill the enemy, to massacre them, and this is the weapon they did it with. It was a shock to the other African tribes that faced the Zulu, and it would be an equal shock to the British army. Their tactical doctrine was the horns of the buffalo. It sounds beautiful in Zulu, that the word, but again I can't pronounce it myself. But effectively means that there'll be veteran warriors in the centre to advance to face the enemy frontally. The youngest, fittest regiments would run out to the left and right flanks like the horns of the buffalo, and it would be their job to encircle them and push them in and trap them in a killing zone to allow those veterans to move up and take them on man to man with these. And if a reserve was required because of casualties in the frontal chest, you would have the loins coming up to reinforce whoever required it, either those in the front or those being fed round, so that your enemy would effectively be encircled and crushed in that buffalo horn formation. And that's exactly what happened to the British forces at Isandhlwana. Strung out in line in front of the camp, They were outflanked on the right by a fast-moving Zulu left horn for them on our right flank. With our right flank hanging in the air, we have no choice but to up and start to fall back on the camp. Zulus move much more quickly than do British soldiers in that climate. We'll have a look at the British army in a minute. But it was a foregone conclusion. As soon as our right flank was unbalanced, it was the end of the battle. The fact that the other horn had come round and encircled us from the rear ensures that it's a massacre, because the Zulus routinely do not take prisoners. Their war doctrine does not allow for prisoners to be taken. It's an extremely rare occasion. The final Zulu weapon that we should mention is the nobkri. Why a Zulu warrior would prefer the nobkri to a spear is purely a matter of choice. But of course it's a simple war club made of iron wood, and it's used for smashing the opponent's skull. You can see it's got quite a long range. The weight of it is all thrown into the ball at the top, so you don't have to wield it particularly hard. You can let the weight of it do all the work. And as it swings forward, once it's aimed for your head, if it hits you, you're going to be stunned badly, and then you can be speared or finished off. This weapon is used as a means of execution for prisoners, for felons in Zulu society. They're often nobkried to death as opposed to being stabbed. Where, curiously, their own wounded, too badly injured for recovery, were often dispatched by a spear thrust under the arm into the heart. So perhaps the Zulus felt that this was a more just means of killing the enemy than the Ikhluwa. Who knows? So that, ladies and gentlemen, is the nature of the Zulu army that we face at Rorke's Drift. The regiments that we face there, as we said before, they're ones that failed to wash their spears at Rorke's Drift. They failed to indulge in hand-to-hand fighting. These men are veterans. Some of them, in their really, really younger days, may have been in the army in the Zulu Civil War in the 1850s. So they may have combat experience, but nothing recent. And their opportunity to fight at Isandhlwana has been denied them. So at the end of the Battle of Isandhlwana, they can see their colleagues in other regiments brandishing captured Martini Henrys and foodstuffs and rations and all the bounty from the camp at Isandhlwana. These men have nothing, and the shame of it bears heavily upon them. So they decide, against the orders of their king, which is not to cross the river into the colony of Natal. Let's keep the moral high ground, says the king. The British have invaded. We will face them in our country. We will not cross the river. But those shamed warriors, deciding that they need some glory, they need some booty, they decide they're going to go and have a fight at Jim's, which was the name for the mission at Rorke's Drift. So we'll leave the Zulu army as those regiments stream off the battlefield at Isandhlwana, looking with hungry eyes at those captured Martinis, and they head off towards Rorke's Drift. They have a 10-mile march ahead of them in the heat of the South African day. They probably haven't had time for food, so they're beginning to be quite tired. And we'll go and have a look at the defenders at Rorke's Drift, the British infantrymen. Call the British infantrymen. Here they come, ladies and gentlemen. Typical examples of soldiers of the 24th Regiment of Foot. Now, I'm not going to give you a massive history lesson on the British Army and its traditions and values, ladies and gentlemen, but what I will say is that the British Army in 1879 is undergoing massive change. Massive changes have been foisted upon it by political decree even. Flogging has been abolished, purchase of officers' commissions have been abolished, and the army is modernising. One of the most radical changes that it faces at this time is they are doing away with the old long service, which in the British Army gave a lot of there were a lot of veterans in it, but it was terribly frowned upon as a career, because the veterans of the army, their hobbies were drinking and fighting each other in the garrison towns around the country, and they were the yobbos of the 1870s. So they had a terrible reputation when on home service. A lot of pubs would deny them service, a lot of theatres would deny them service, but they were the heroes of the Sunday papers when they were fighting across the empire. And in order to try and change that, to steal away these long service, brutalised men, short service had just been developed. And that meant that a man could now serve a period on the reserve as well as a period with the colours. So a man could do 6 years with his regiment and then go on the reserve, where he'd return to civilian life, get fourpence a day, and in time of major war he could be called back. So he'd be on the what they call the reserve. And soldiers were just beginning to sign on under those new terms. When the 24th arrives in South Africa, the colonists look at them, the bearded, mustachioed veterans, and they look every inch the veteran soldiers that they were. They look at the 3rd Battalion 60th Rifles and the 57th Middlesex, who are out from England, and they look like the beardless youths that they are. So the army's on the change. But for this, we're going to concentrate on the 24th, the soldiers that fight at Rorke's Drift. We'll have a quick look at their uniform and equipment, and then we'll turn to their weaponry. Now, a lot of you here, I understand, have been to South Africa, so you know how damned hot it is out there. These soldiers are in their tropical uniform. You're probably thinking to yourself, Christ, they don't fight in that lot, do they? They absolutely do. Because, how many of you have been to South Africa and visited the battlefields? A significant number. It's dreadfully hot looking, isn't it? However, if you go out there in a pair of shorts and a vest, you're not going to do too well in the sun either. This thick uniform inures you to that climate pretty well. Yes, you're going to be hot, you're going to sweat, it's going to be uncomfortable, but you're going to be protected from the climate. Ammunition boots, thick as you like, maintained by the cobblers within the battalion. Heavily studded on the bottom to save the leather, because you can't go shopping for a new pair of boots in Zululand. Trousers, patched here for a very good reason on the right knee. I'll go into that later when we talk about rifles. A thick pair of leather anklets round the ankle. One quick anecdote about that. When we were out there on a big reenactment, some 10 or 12 years ago now, one day, one of our chaps was on the sick list. We were at Rorke's Drift for the day with Ian. It was very hot, so this chap on the sick thinks, I'm not putting those leather anklets on, most very uncomfortable. I'm going to leave them right off. Leaves them off. A spider obligingly crawled up his boot, settled on his ankle, bit him, spat him out, but that chap damn near lost his foot. So, those leather anklets, uncomfortable they may be, but they protect you from the flora and the fauna of South Africa very well. As do the trousers, thick wool worsted. Same with a red coat. Why do we wear a red coat? Why be so specific? Why not conceal ourselves with a bit of khaki or something like that? The simple fact is that we don't regard the Zulus highly as marksmen. They could knit a barn door, doesn't matter if we wear red. Red impresses natives, we're going to damn well wear it. We will impress them with our steadiness, and we will overwhelm them like that. That is the tactical thinking, combined with the fact that our rifles still black powder firing. So, as soon as you let fly, divot of white smoke from every rifle. They know exactly where you are. In a native's country, they know where you are every step you take. Their scouts are out, and the Zulus were fantastic scouts. They knew exactly where our forces were. Completely and utterly out-scouted were we on the days leading up to Sundwana. So it doesn't matter what colour you wear, red, blue, it didn't matter. The Foreign Legion wear their blue in the desert, and we damn well wear our red in our deserts and our Zulu land. The only concession to the climate is this sun helmet. At home, the regiments are wearing either the last pattern shako, blue cloth, Frenchified looking shako, or some of them have the new police-like blue cloth helmet with its regimental insignia on it. But this is a very good helmet for foreign service. It's only made of cork, it's light as a feather, it deflects no blows, but it does what it's designed for, which is to keep the sun off your head. The South Africans will call us Rooinecks, rednecks, because the helmet doesn't quite protect that back of your neck. So a lot of soldiers will tuck their handkerchief down the back of that on the march, just to stop the sun burning you around the nether regions of your neck here. Now, in terms of equipment, the equipment is to provide the man with his requirements on campaign. So let's have a look at it. It's made of buffalo leather, particularly thick, hard wearing leather, which has this yellowish hue. It's relatively impervious to water. This set has not been pipe clayed as is required for our home service set. This set here has once been pipe clayed. Now, before the campaign, this man would wash off all this pipe clay and return it to the less obtrusive brownish colour. And the tunic itself is going to fade pretty quickly in the South African sun. On the pouches here, 20 rounds of Martini Henry ammunition in each pouch, in packets of 10. In this pouch here, the expense pouch, when you open a packet of ammunition, you put the loose rounds into that. Your basic load is 70 rounds. So you have 40 in the pouches here, your additional 30 you'll have in your pockets or in your backpack. Can you turn around, Corp? On the back, this is light marching order. We have a, it's not waterproof, but it's a cape. If it does rain, this will keep you warm still. The off-duty cap for the evenings when you need your head to be kept warm. And in here, the mess tin, which will in which the soldier will receive his ration, his cooked meal, and he'll shave out of it, just use it for various tasks like that. Thanks, Corp. Around the front again. In the haversack down here, we have the uneaten portion of the day's rations or any small items that the soldier might want for his day. His pipe, things of that nature, spare socks. His main backpack, which hangs over his loins at the back, will be moved on wagon transport in Zululand, so at least he doesn't have to cart that. The most vital thing for the soldier in Zululand is the water bottle. This is the Oliver pattern wooden keg water bottle. There it is, made like a little barrel, properly coopered. Quite a good item, but the problem with it is being wooden, you have to keep some water in it. If you drink it dry, it'll crack very quickly. It's lined with beeswax, but that last few mouthfuls starts to taste more and more of beeswax. And if you drink it all, you're left with a dry bottle which will crack, and next time you fill it, it'll just leak out. So a soldier has to keep about a quarter of that bottle moist at the bottom to stop it from cracking. So not an excellent piece of kit, but a vital one nonetheless. This soldier here, he's not wearing his... This is fighting order, and this is the order of dress that will be worn at the Battle of Rorke's Drift. The braces are discarded, so is the rolled cape. The man's just carrying the equipment he needs to fight. And let's have a look at his weapons next. We're going to deal with close quarter fighting first, because after that we're going to go out and we're going to see some Martini Henry firing in the snow. I don't think that's ever been seen before, so that's a bit of a first. Bayonets. Now, Private Atkinson here. Port Arms Private Atkinson, if you please. Private Atkinson there has the 1853 bayonet. This is the real anorak stuff, ladies and gentlemen. I know you're Zulu War anoraks. I know, I can tell. That is the 1853 pattern bayonet that goes originally with the three-band Enfield. Now, the three-band Enfield is quite a long weapon, so the bayonet doesn't have to be that long to do its primary function when this is designed, which is repelling cavalry and preventing horses charging home when the rifle and fixed bayonet is levelled towards them in a square formation. So that is the 1853 pattern. When the Martini Henry rifle comes out, they simply bush it because the Martini has a smaller barrel than the Enfield, and they use that bayonet. After a while, the War Office think, well, hang on a minute, we're still in danger from cavalry, really, in Europe, aren't we? Yes, I think we need a longer bayonet to compensate for the Martini Henry's shorter length. So, this bayonet, the 1876 Lunger bayonet, comes out and is longer than that originally issued. So, in Zululand, both these types are on issue. It's impossible. I've tried to find out what was used at Isandlwana and Rorke's Drift. It's impossible to say. It could be the 53 bushed, or it might be the Lunger, the 76. They're basically the same. Triangular section, blood fullered, so they can get in and out easily, and long enough, both of them really, to repel charging cavalry. There's another type of bayonet in use by British forces, and that is the Sergeant's Yagatan bayonet. This is it. Sergeants only had this Yagatan. Yagatan, I think, is a Turkish expression, and it's a bayonet designed during the muzzle loading era, and it's designed so that it curls away from the action of the hand when it's ramming down the charge on a muzzle loader. Quite why sergeants retain that bayonet is a mystery to me, because it's extremely heavy, it's very cumbersome, and the fact that it sits on the side of the rifle makes it really awkward to use.